Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The healthcare law, it's not, but today's Supreme Court ruling on immigration is a very big deal indeed. Also on the broadcast today, hey look, I'm now the mayor of 261 South Figueroa. A conversation from the corner office at Foursquare. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 25th of June. Good to have you with us. The Supreme Court spoke this morning, not on health care, as you may have already heard. The big case du jour was Arizona et al. Versus United States, about Arizona's immigration law, known as SB 1070. It was a mixed ruling. Most of the law was struck down. Its most controversial provision, though, was upheld. From the Fronteras desk at KJZZ in Phoenix, Peter O'Dowd starts us off today.
The state of Arizona has already spent nearly $3 million defending the law, and the investment was worth it, according to state leaders like Governor Jan Brewer. She called the court's ruling a victory for states like Arizona struggling with illegal immigration.
We cannot forget that we are here today because the federal government has failed the American people regarding immigration policy, has failed to protect its citizens, has failed to preserve the rule of law, and has failed to secure our borders.
The court struck down three provisions of the law, but upheld what supporters call the heart of SB 1070, the part that requires police to check the immigration status of anyone they reasonably suspect is in the country illegally.
I consider it a win.
Larry Deaver is sheriff of Cochise County, which borders Mexico. He says the ruling will be a deterrent for illegal immigrants to cross into the United States.
One of the purposes of it was to deliver a very strong message to people coming into Arizona that this is not the place you want to come. And so we anticipate reduced traffic across the border.
So what does that mean for the state's economy? Pablo Alvarado, who heads the National Day Laborer Organizing Network, puts it this way.
It only makes it more difficult.
Since 2009, it's estimated that more than 100,000 illegal immigrants left Arizona on their own. It's unclear whether it was the state's weak job market or the political climate that spurred the departure. But Alvarado says workers in low-skilled industries like construction and agriculture will go further underground.
And the question is how that employer is going to replace that worker. And obviously, this has a huge impact in the economy in Arizona.
Not everyone in these industries expects a mass exodus of workers. Tim Dunn is a farmer in the southern Arizona city of Yuma. He says most of the people who planned on leaving already have. Dunn grows broccoli and wheat, and he barely has enough seasonal workers to get by.
The longer we debate whether or not the state can enforce the laws or the federal government has to enforce the laws, we're not focusing on the visa reform and labor needs that we need. We're just focusing on who has the right to do the enforcement.
Dunn hopes the country moves quickly on immigration and visa reform, because once the economy picks up again, he's going to need a lot more workers in his fields. In Phoenix, I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace.
The Department of Homeland Security figures about a quarter of all undocumented immigrants in the United States are here in the state of California. We've figured the whole discussion that's going on in this country right now about Arizona's law, sure, but similar laws in other states, has affected immigrants' decisions on where to live when they get here. We sent Marketplace's Jeff Tyler out this morning to find out.
Outside a Home Depot in downtown Los Angeles, a couple dozen Latino men look for work as day laborers. A guy who gives his name as Leopoldo arrived from Mexico without papers 15 days ago. I asked if the immigration laws in Arizona had any influence over where he decided to relocate.
I don't know anything about the immigration laws. I came here looking for work because the life back in Mexico is very difficult.
Earning money is his primary motivation. He says he would risk going to Arizona if it meant getting a good job.
Yes, if they have opportunities. If I could get permanent work there, yes.
Others I spoke with came to Los Angeles because they have relatives here.
Toda mi familia aquí está.
All my family is here, says Prospero de Leon from Guatemala. He considers Arizona's laws to be racist and said he wouldn't go there even if a job offered good pay. For the most part, family connections and economic opportunity seem to drive migration patterns. Jeff Passell is senior demographer with the Pew Hispanic Center. He says tougher laws have had an impact.
We know from a number of studies that the stepped-up enforcement along the southwestern border has made it much more expensive to get smuggled into the United States.
And with fewer job opportunities during the recession, Pasal says more and more Mexican migrants have decided it's in their economic interest to stay home. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders probably wish they'd stayed home. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I remember being in Miami about 3-4 years ago now and seeing high-rise after high-rise after high-rise of apartment buildings, condos, that had been abandoned mid-construction, just sitting there, half done, after one of the most brutal real estate busts in the country. Today, Miami condos are actually selling quite nicely. Thank you. Prices are rising. Inventories are falling. But how come? From WLRN, Karen Burkett explains.
Some locals are buying property. Ashley Ahrens hopes to become one of them.
I like the crazy in Miami. I like the excitement, the moving, the lights.
The city's appeal has her talking commitment. She says she's ready to settle in and become a condo owner. If Ahrens buys today, she doesn't think she'll be overpaying for a one-bedroom, one-bath.
It's cheaper in the long run for me to buy a condo at this point in time. I don't have to worry about having my rent raised.
Ahrens' year-and-a-half hunt for a condo has tested her patience.
In the time I've been searching, I've put bids in on almost 10 properties.
And nothing. This 29-year-old attorney has repeatedly been beaten on offers by cash buyers who've just pounced on the deals.
What I think a unit is worth, if there's a cash buyer that really, really loves it, it's going to get blown out of the water.
These buyers are investors from countries like Argentina, Brazil, Mexico, Spain, even Russia. Plenty of local realtors will tell you international investors saved the market. But foreign investors shop for properties in other U.S. cities, too. West Los Angeles, Manhattan, Seattle, Phoenix. In fact, in terms of property values, Phoenix is the only market hotter than Miami right now. See, during the recession, Miami's skyline was filled with beautiful condo towers that sat completely empty. Now, 90% are owned or rented.
All our sales are to foreign capital sources or high net worth foreign individuals who are looking for U.S. income-producing assets.
RJ De Barona works for a company called The Solution Group. They buy properties, fix them up, rent them out, and then sell. A very different business model from the years when flippers were buying on spec. De Barona says foreign investors consider the United States low risk because it has a stable political system and economy. Unstable is how Michael Allen described his financial situation.
I had a one-bedroom, one-and-a-half-bath, 768 square feet.
Did it have a balcony?
It had a balcony, 15th floor. You see the water.
Even though he owned a condo in Miami, the 35-year-old video editor wanted to sell because he was burdened with condo fees. He was paying extra to make up for owners who defaulted on their mortgages. The first time Allen put his condo on the market was 2 years ago.
In 2010, I tried to sell it, and I had nobody come look at it. Same realtor this year. The night we put it on the MLS, I had my first bid, even before they really come look at it. They just knew it. Turns out that they lived in the building, too. They just wanted another unit. So they had their eye on it.
Cash buyer?
Cash buyer, European.
What do you think about all these cash buyers swooping in and picking up condos?
I think it's great. I needed it. And they came in, and they saved me.
In the end, Allen ended up moving to a quieter, more affordable city called Pompano Beach. Still local, but 45 minutes away from waterfront Miami.
I got double the square footage for less money. And I've had quite a bit of money to play around and make it exactly how I like. New kitchen, new tiles, a lot of peace. And I want that now.
For this seller, a foreign investor brought relief. But for buyers, higher prices and outside competition, it just adds to the stress of condo hunting in Miami's suddenly hot market. In Miami, I'm Karen Burkett for Marketplace.
All Another day, another bailout in the Eurozone, courtesy this time of Cyprus. It's the fifth country to ask for help, if you're keeping track. All the Euro drama, though, is unsettling the UK. London's FTSE stock index was down about 1% today. Manufacturing is off there. The British economy is shrinking. Brits are in the middle of their second recession since the 2008 financial crisis. That crisis is the backdrop for John Lanchester's new novel. It's called Capital, about the residents of one upwardly mobile block in London and their combined financial fates. John Lanchester, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kai.
The London property bubble is, in a way, at the heart of this book. And what happens on the main street there that you have set it on, Pepys Road in London, and the neighbors and the environment that they have there. And what happened is that these people became, as their properties gained in value, they became very well off.
You know, when you get these sort of global bubbles, there is a collective madness. And it reached very deep here. People treated their houses basically as if they were gigantic ATM machines, which only dispense cash. But I wanted to catch that moment of obliviousness, because there's something very interesting about obliviousness and people not knowing what's about to happen.
And it was collective obliviousness, and it was willful obliviousness.
Willful and willed. You know, at the peak of the boom, I don't know, three times a week the phone would ring, an unsolicited call offering credit. And the thing about credit is actually it's something in the old days people used to call debt. You know, debt used to be a bad thing. They renamed it credit, and now we all want more. And I think that it is a thing that is caused by, you know, large institutions that have, you know, lost their compass and lost their sense of, you know, what responsible lending is.
One of the other themes that runs through this book, and I'll try to do this without giving too much away, but there's an element of we want what you have. Somebody shows up at these houses on Pepys Road and sends them postcards literally saying we want what you have. And, of course, the thing that came to my mind was the debate that's happening in this country over Occupy Wall Street and tax the rich and the 1% and the 99%.
I think that, you know, there's a lot of our society is based on this basic motive of wanting things that we see. We spend a lot of our day being encouraged to want stuff. And that's a theme in the book, that thing about people looking at things and wanting the thing that is just very slightly out of their reach.
Well, and it's reflected in the title as well, Capital. I mean, obviously, it's the city of London, the capital of England, but it's obviously the notion of capital and finance and how important it is, not just in your characters' lives, but in the lives that we all lead.
For sure. Yeah. And, you know, if you're struggling to pay the bills, you're not very interested in the abstract sense in which we have collectively lost our moral compass about capital. But, you know, we've traveled a long way down this particular road, broadly speaking, since the early 80s. You know, it's very interesting that the three really big pieces that came out in the 80s about that moment, the movie Wall Street, Michael Lewis's Liar's Poker, Tom Wolfe writing The Bonfire of the Vanities about Masters of the Universe, that was supposed to be a blistering excoriation. And they adopted it as a motto. You know, they all coined phrases, greed is good. That became a slogan for Wall Street. They loved that.
So what's the line coming out of this book? What's your Masters of the Universe or greed is good?
I guess that the world is full of people saying that they want what we have.
Yeah.
And we in the developed West, we have a lot on our minds, but we also tend to forget that we're some of the richest and luckiest people who've ever lived. And, you know, maybe there are moments when we should pause and remember what it is that we do have.
The book is called Capital. It's a novel by John Lanchester. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Kai.
Here's today's note that the rich really are different from you and me. We read this morning that a New York hedge fund manager who's getting divorced is suing his soon-to-be ex-wife to get part of her enormous collection of very expensive shoes in the settlement. So we did what we do when I have fashion questions. We called up fashion writer Kate Betts in today, appropriately, Milan, Italy.
Yes, I'm in the land where they make expensive shoes.
Well, let me ask you about this. So if this guy gets these shoes from his wife in the divorce settlement, what's the resale value on, like, Christian Louboutin, you know, size 7.5, 4.5-inch platform heel thing?
Well, I mean, a lot of these shoes retail for about between $800 and $1,200. So I don't know, the resale value is probably half of that or more if they've never been worn. I mean, can she wear 1,200 pairs of shoes in one lifetime? I don't know.
Remind me, which are the ones with the red soles on them? Is that Louboutin or the other guy?
Those are Christian Louboutin.
Oh, Louboutin, I'm saying it wrong.
Yeah.
Louboutin, there you go. Kate Betts, her book is called Everyday Icon, Michelle Obama and the Power of Style. Coming up, the age-old question asked of new technology companies, how are you going to make money?
People ask us all the time, and like the story is getting a lot easier to tell as people start to see the things that we're doing within the app.
A chat with the CEO at Foursquare, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials remain stuck in the same old groove over Europe. The blue chip sank another 138 points today, slightly more than 1%. 12,502 is where the Dow came to rest. The Nasdaq lopped off 56 points, nearly 2%, 2836. The S&P 500 lagged 21 points, a bit more than 1.5%. Not to get all superstitious on you, but this isn't the first time this year the S&P has settled at 1313, you know. Shares of Anheuser-Busch bubbled up 0.75% today on reports the company may be ready to completely swallow up Grupo Modelo, which brews Corona beer. That news also caused shares of Constellation Brands to jump nearly 13% today. Constellation holds a distribution deal for Corona. Bond prices today higher. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.6%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at Marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. President Obama is scheduled to be in Atlanta and Miami for campaign events. And the United Nations observes the International Day Against Drug Abuse and Illicit Trafficking. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, so unless the justices are doing a huge constitutional head fake on us, Thursday is going to be Healthcare Day. But it turns out that whether the Supreme Court tosses the whole Affordable Care Act or upholds the whole thing or does something in between, some of the changes that law brought to American health care are here to stay. From New Hampshire Public Radio, Dan Gorenstein reports.
3 years ago, David Jost was playing wiffle ball. He slid awkwardly on his left ankle. He thought, a sprain. Turned out, it was much worse.
My left ankle never stopped hurting. Then some months later, my wrists started hurting. Then months later, my shoulders started hurting. And then my knees and then my hips and ankles again, even more. And yep, it's done pretty much a full circle around my body.
David and his parents saw all the local specialists, neurologists, orthopedists, chiropractors, and acupuncturists. Nobody had answers.
It's really scary having something that just gets worse and worse and doctors can't figure out.
So the family traveled 350 miles north to the Cleveland Clinic four different times. There, David's dad, Timothy, says they saw something they hadn't seen in a year's worth of doctor visits back home in Virginia.
Every doctor knew what the other doctors had done. He didn't have to go over everything all over again.
Timothy Jost is not just a concerned father. The Washington and Lee Law Professor is one of the nation's top health experts. He's worked with the Obama administration to roll out the Affordable Care Act, and he thinks what his son experienced in Cleveland is the future for the rest of us, no matter what happens to the health care law.
It's a really different model of the health care system, and I think one of the hopes is that we will be able to focus more on the patient and less on generating as many procedures and tests as one can.
At the clinic, doctors work together, so patients aren't tested and retested for the same problem. Electronic records keep information flowing, and that cuts cost and frustration. It's all about efficiency. This kind of approach, which led to David Jost's diagnosis of celiac disease, is catching on across the country. And Dartmouth-Hitchcock Hospital in New Hampshire is one of the trailblazers.
There's a picture on my wall right here. It's the cover of a New Yorker magazine.
Dartmouth-Hitchcock President Jim Weinstein shows me the painting. It's a glass of orange juice about half full. I've missed the point, says Weinstein.
It isn't half full or half empty. It's the wrong glass. And right now we have the wrong glass for healthcare.
That's Weinstein's way of saying the nearly $3 trillion healthcare system is broken, that the system is set up to reward more care rather than better care.
We could make a lot more money doing a lot more spine surgery. I'm a spine surgeon. That's not where we want to be.
The federal government and some private insurers are inclined to agree. They've signed contracts and started pilot programs with hospitals like Dartmouth to pay doctors for improved health of their patients rather than the number of procedures performed.
The current system and or systems have failed. We're going to create the future, not wait for the future to happen.
Most health experts agree. Making medicine more efficient and less costly is important, but these ideas on their own aren't enough to rescue the healthcare system. Michael Cannon is a health policy expert with the conservative Cato Institute.
Every few years, people come up with a new buzzword, a new way that we're going to finally reduce the cost of healthcare or improve the quality of healthcare. But really, none of these ideas, none of these ways of financing or delivering healthcare is a silver bullet.
Cannon is hoping the entire Affordable Care Act will be thrown out by the Supreme Court on Thursday. But even if it is, many of these changes encouraged by the law are here to stay. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
On the timeline of meaningful, by which I mean successful, social media companies, first there was Facebook, then Twitter, and then 3 or so years ago, something called Foursquare. It's an app for your smartphone that you use to check in someplace and let other users know where you are, be it a coffee shop or a cool new restaurant someplace. Foursquare went pretty quickly from startup to actual business. It's got more than 20 million users right now, but it's also got a problem because some of the buzz has worn off. It went from hot new thing to just thing. So the company launched a new and improved version this month that, besides all the location sharing stuff, also makes recommendations for where you can go and what to do when you get there. Today, then, another conversation from the corner office, this one with Foursquare co-founder and CEO Dennis Crowley. Dennis, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having us.
I wanted to start with the revamp, the overhaul that you guys rolled out a couple of weeks ago. I mean, you had an amazing 2009, 2010 was great. And then things kind of got slow, right?
I wouldn't say it got slow. I mean, the growth has been great for us. Every Friday is bigger than the Friday before. And
so why the new paradigm then? Maybe that's a better question.
When we built the app, we built it in 2009. And then, you start hiring people, you got 10, you got 20 people, and we're still building on top of that same thing that we built in 2009. And after a while, the app starts to get a little bit crowded, right? Like, we just kept building things on top of it. And, it came to the point where it's like, listen, there's so many things that we want to do. Like, we're going to have to start simplifying and taking this apart and then figuring out what is the best way to put them back together so it tells the story of Foursquare in 2012.
How do you make money, though, man? You got to turn a profit.
People ask us all the time, and the story is getting a lot easier to tell as people start to see the things that we're doing within the app. What we're finding is, as good as we are at helping people connect to places, we're also starting to be really good at helping places connect to people. So, hey, you just opened this type of restaurant in this particular area. Well, here's some folks that you might want to reach out to because there's a good chance that they could be really valuable customers for you someday.
You guys went to South by Southwest in 2009, and that's where you really exploded. That's where people said, whoa, what is this thing? And I want to check it out. And you got really the big boost, and which is a great phenomenon, and that's all fun. But what I want to know is, what's it like to be the new thing? What happens when that happens?
I don't know. I think it's really easy to get caught up in people being really excited about what you're doing. But at the end of the day, you really have to pay attention to the way that people are interacting with the product. Even though the numbers are going up, are people sticking around? Are people staying with the product for a while? In 2009, we just didn't have the energy to really – not even energy, but we didn't have the time or the resources to really pay attention to a lot of that stuff. And now that the company's matured, now that we're, about 120 people, we have people specifically tasked to looking at the metrics and tweaking all the different things that we're doing in the product.
Yeah. Do you ever talk to guys like Biz Stone who helped start Twitter and, of course, Zuckerberg at Facebook? Do you ever talk to them and say, so what'd you learn that I might learn from?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Do you really?
I haven't talked to Biz in a while. There's not a ton of people. you know, that have gone through this before. And so there's a lot of us that lean on each other to figure out, like, what are the best – like, how do you get through certain problems? And different companies are at different scales. But you look at the companies that are, you know, around our size, around our scale, and, you know, like, we get together in New York pretty regularly. We get together in San Francisco pretty regularly. Mm. And there's a nice little support group of people that are all trying to figure this out, you know, together.
There's a flip side to that question, right? You are, what, 36, 37, something like that?
36.
36, okay. Without trying to crush your youthful dreams, I mean, you are, to a 21, 22-year-old kid, you're like some old guy, right?
Yeah,
what kind of advice do you give to the young people starting up who say, I want to do what you're doing?
You know, I didn't really start building my own stuff until I was like 24 or 25 or so. And even then, you know, I just ran into a lot of resistance from, like, older folks, you know, like my bosses at other companies or people in the industry that are like, oh, that's an interesting idea, but it'll never work, right? Mm. And I know I kind of believed everything that they told me. And it wasn't until we started building, you know, really building our own stuff just because we wanted to. And then, you know, we wanted to build it. We wanted to prove to ourselves that it wouldn't work, or we had a strong enough hunch that the stuff we were really passionate about was interesting and we probably could make it work. And once we started doing that, we realized, hey, some of our ideas are pretty good. And so that's the advice I always pass on to other folks. It's like, don't listen to people that don't think that your ideas are very interesting. You know, mm-hmm. You should go out there and prove that to yourself.
Dennis Crowley. He's a co-founder and CEO of Foursquare. Dennis, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time. Appreciate it.
If you want to hear more from Dennis Crowley, like how he and his friends came up with the idea of Foursquare, there's more of our conversation on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, I am so, quote, working from home tomorrow. I don't know if you saw this, but Bloomberg Businessweek had an item today. It turns out people who work from home sometimes don't. A survey by Wakefield Research shows 43% of people who work from home watch a TV or movie during traditional office hours. 24% of them say they have a drink, but that is kind of the whole point about working from home anyway, isn't it, right? Making work fit your life and not the other way around, so long as the work gets done. Our work here is done. Our producers include Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for more of the same tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.